Always Well in the Smallville is brought to you by listeners like you. Nathan McKenzie, Tim Miller, John Curcio, Jazz Amaja, Chris Fuchs, John Lloyd, Atif Sheik, Justin Maintner, Gavante Chillis, Molly Ficarella, Thomas Navin, Mike Franz, Joe Mickendo, Trayvon Brady, Dylan D'Antonio, Steve Rogers, Eddie Bissell, Cameron Minard, Nick Ryan Magdoza, T. Hamill, Becca Zeifel, Nicholas Casso, Tom Gerke, Nicholas Fansler, Jared Gibbs, and Erica Flynn. Thank you so much to all these patrons. And you too can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alwaysmallville with one S. Hope to see you there.
I'm Michael Rosenbaum, Lex Luthor, and always hold on to Smallville.
Welcome to Always Hold On to Smallville. In this podcast, we talk about each and every episode of The Young Superman Show. We ran from 2001 to 2011 on the WB and the CW. I'm your host, Zach Moore. And we're not talking about Smallville this time because we have a Superman special. We're talking about Superman 2, the Lester Cut, the Donner Cut, the adventure continues. And I'm very happy to be joined by my friend, John Mills. What's up, John?
Hello, Zach. Thank you for having me on. I'm thrilled and excited to be talking about Superman 2.
Now, John and I, we have podcasted in other venues over the past and met through Star Trek and my other podcast, Franchise Fatigue, if you guys aren't listening to that, please do. Me and my friend Brandon Shea Metella go through movie franchises. We talk about sequels, remakes, reboots, and all that fun stuff. Just a fun excuse to watch some movies that we've either never seen or love and want to watch again, and examine when franchises get fatigued. And we haven't gotten to the Superman franchise just yet over there. We will down the road. And John, you'll be back over there for that as well.
Oh, you know it. You know it.
But over there, you know, what kind of inspired this whole conversation is recently we were talking about the Jaws franchise and how it kind of paralleled the Superman franchise in many ways. Three of the four movies came out the same years as other movies, and that the third one is similar to the fourth one, the trajectory, and all these sorts of things. But go check out our conversation about those over there. But John, it came up, we were talking, I know you've been a Superman fan, I always knew that, and Superman the movie is one of your favorite movies of all time, correct?
That is absolutely correct. Superman the movie is one of the finest pieces of cinema I think I've ever seen in my life.
Excellent. I rank it my favorite superhero movie of all time.
It's definitely in the conversation. I might break toward The Dark Knight, but I think that when you start talking about those types of conversations, there's a lot of emotional stuff that goes on. And yes. The Dark Knight came out at a very important time in my life. And so like it almost always gets the sort of like the go ahead push just because I associate it with some specific memories. But, I would never reject the idea of Superman being the best of the comic book movies.
I remember, it's funny you say that, I dressed up as the Joker, Heath Ledger's Joker, for the midnight premiere of The Dark Knight.
Oh, no.
And I was interviewed by a local news station. And I don't know if I've shared this story or even this clip on the podcast. If not, I will find it and I will share it with all y'all. But, you know, they interviewed me, and it's funny because it says my name, Zach Moore, the Joker, underneath, right? And I'm dressed up like Heath Ledger's Joker and stuff, which is, by the way, a great compromise to dress up as, because, you know, if you try to dress up like Jack Nicholson Joker, you got to be so proper and all that. You could be messy with the makeup if you're Heath Ledger's Joker. That's what's great about
point.
That. I found
point.
Like a $40 suit at Suit Mart. It was like burgundy. It worked. Got the point across, right?
Nice.
The point is, they asked me, like, hey, what'd you think? And I said, and this is literally what I say. Well, I'm a Superman guy, so for me, Superman the movie, that's number one, but this is a solid number two. Like, give it the midnight premiere of this. And I'm like, everyone else is like, oh, it's the greatest movie I've ever seen, right? And look, I love The Dark Knight, but, you know, you got to keep these things in perspective. So anyway.
Mm-hmm. No, I love the idea of you dressed as Heath Ledger's Joker declaring that you were Oh, I just watched the second best superhero movie of all time.
Yes, yes. But anyway, Superman the movie leads to Superman 2. Now, we've talked about Superman the movie here on the podcast, specifically when the three-hour cut came out from Warner Archive on Blu-ray. John, did you pick up that three-hour cut?
I have access to a copy of the television cut, and yeah, man, it's really tough because it's one of those things where everything's great and I love it, but it definitely, the pacing is for commercial breaks in a two-night TV event. It was never supposed to be that. And so it's almost like releasing, not literally, but it's like releasing the rough cut of something and saying, this is the true vision of the, no. The version that was released was Richard Donner's vision. It's cool. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad I own it because I like owning all these versions, right? Yeah. And we were very fortunate to have it on Blu-ray because they basically found it on a film reel on a shelf somewhere. And they're like, let's restore this and release it, right? So that's great. If I had to pick my preferred version to watch Superman the movie, I might have changed my opinion since the last time I said on this podcast. I don't know, guys. So much life happens between recordings of podcasts. Yeah. I never remember what I say. But I would say the special edition or the extended cut or whatever it's called, the one that came out in 2000, 2001, is my preferred version because it has, you know, an extra Marlon Brando scene in the fortress. Mm-hmm. It has the Luther's gauntlet with the fire and the bullets and the ice.
Yes.
Little extensions like Krypton, small little extensions. Richard Donner oversaw this special edition. And I think that's a great compromise between the two. What about you, John? Are you a theatrical guy, or do you like that special edition?
No, I do. I do like the extended version a little bit better because I am old enough to remember the TV version. It would have been replayed. When did the TV version first air? I don't remember.
It was probably the early 80s.
Yeah,
not 1980 or so.
If it was like 80-ish or a little bit after that, I would have been old enough because I remembered for the longest time, I know it's called Luther's Gauntlet, but I was like, I remember him being like frozen in ice and stuff like that. And then it wasn't until the extended version. I was like, I knew I didn't imagine that stuff.
Well, that's the thing from the 80s, all these extended TV cuts.
Yep.
You know, we've talked about Halloween before, again, on, you know, a similar movie podcast. And yeah. There's TV cuts of Halloween 2, there's TV cuts of Star Trek 2, Superman the movie, Superman 2, and it must have been crazy, like, you must have thought you were crazy, because you're used to seeing a movie a certain way on TV, finally comes out on VHS or DVD, or whenever you end up buying it and watching it again, you're like, wait a minute, where are all these scenes that I used to watch?
Yes.
And you don't know where they went, and, you know, now all these movies are being restored and all that kind of thing. I would say, you know, a lot of people complain about Luther's gauntlet, like, oh, well, it doesn't make story sense anyway, because Luther knows that bullets can't hurt him. Well, I would say, one, it looks really cool, so totally worth it for that, but two, I choose to see it as Luther lulling Superman to a false sense of security, because he's like, oh, what's this guy shooting bullets at me, fire, ice, come on, I'm invincible, right? He goes in there, and so he's completely like, look, I got this guy, and that's why he's so taken aback when the kryptonite shows up, so that's my interpretation of it.
I think that's a completely valid interpretation. I also, you know, to piggyback off of that, that it would be, I really like that read a whole lot. I'm going to adopt it as my own now. But I'd always taken it just as, you know, he's a Bond-level villain, and so these are just the traps that would have been set anyway, and it's just to establish again how undefeatable Superman is. So when you see that kryptonite around his neck and he's, you know, paralyzed and drowning, like, you've been reminded very recently how strong he is and how, you know, terrible that kryptonite is. Like, it really sort of ups the stakes in a way.
Yeah, you're right. And if there's one shot where he looks like the most pathetic, he's like in the pool and he's trying so hard to get it over his neck and he just can't do it. It's like, come on, man.
Yeah.
The same version of Superman lifts a kryptonite continent with kryptonite in his back just a couple movies later, right, John?
Well, he'd been gone for a few years, and let's not even open up the debate as to why he would retain his powers if he traveled away from the sun that gave him his strength. You know, we're not going to worry about that part of it.
Yes, we're not here to talk about Superman Returns. We will get to that one day in the podcast at the appropriate time. But Superman 2, right? So I was hoping to kind of come back around to why I introduced even these extended cuts. Anyway, I was hoping, oh, great. they released Superman the movie, the extended cut, on Blu-ray. Surely, on one of those shelves, they have Superman 2 and Superman 3 and maybe even a Superman 4 extended cut somewhere. Those have yet to materialize. Destroy Superman now.
But first, have fun.
But those have not materialized yet, and I'm starting to worry that they might not. So I was like, well, we were talking about Superman 2. I'm in a hiatus here between the seasons. What a perfect time to talk about Superman 2 here on the podcast. And I've never actually seen a complete... it's referred to in fandom now as the Restored International Cut, the TV version of Superman 2. I've seen the deleted scenes and the clips and stuff, but I've never like seen it properly. So I guess I'm just going to have to go find it somewhere since WB refuses to release it for us. So, but that's its own conversation. But Superman 2, right, has two versions, famously. The Richard Donner cut and the theatrical/the Richard Lester cut. And there's so much mythology behind that. So John, I didn't prepare you for this, but would you be interested in telling the story in a brief summary of why there's two different cuts of Superman 2?
Because the Salkinds didn't understand exactly how integral Richard Donner was to what made Superman the movie work.
In a nutshell, yes.
There you go. There's your summary. Big head producers get bigger heads and think that they can survive without the director who got them there. So, and I, you know, never mind the fact that, you know, in the production history, if I'm remembering correctly, Donner had to fight for a couple of decisions along the way, and they didn't understand, obviously, that he was a necessary check against some of their instincts. And that's why you wind up with him getting replaced by Richard Lester. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I remember very specifically, because I was a big fan of Starlog magazine back when I was a young child. I remember seeing a set photo with Richard Thomas in the Superman suit, John Boy from Little House on the Prairie. And I, to this day, cannot remember whether they were saying he was going to replace Christopher Reeve in a new version of Superman 2, and they were screen testing him, or if it was post Superman 2 and they were thinking of replacing Reeve for 3.
I was unaware of that. It might have been an audition, perhaps.
Yeah.
For the first film, maybe for Superman the musical. You know, yeah, I'm not right? sure. But no, I was unaware of that. But the Salkinds is notoriously cheap. Right? There's actually, I believe it's called the Salklein Clause now. And it's because they actually had shot some Three Musketeers movies. And Richard Lester was the director. So they shot this big, long Three Musketeer movie. And they paid everybody for one movie. And then they tried to chop it into two and release it as two films with only paying the cast and the crew for one film. And that led to the Salkind Clause. So they were always looking to cut corners. They were independent producers, you know. So there was a lot going on there. A lot of conflict throughout the whole production. And the idea for Superman and Superman the movie was they were going to be shot simultaneously, not back to back, not like Back to the Future, you know, part 2 and 3, which were shot back to back first and then next. This is like Lord of the Rings style, right? So this is really ahead of its time. They shot them at the same time. To quote Superman 3, at the same time. So that is why they're in this very unique situation where we have a director who was fired. But he had directed, you know, reports go as high as 80% of the film, the second film. So Superman 1 and Superman 2, they were nearing completion. But in order to, you know, they were falling behind, going over budget. These are all, you know, the Salkinds, you know, they're not 100% black hatters. I think they did have some points here. Richard Donner as well, he had kind of an edge to him. You know, he had like, you know, did some interviews where he kind of spoke disparagingly about them, so they took offense to that. So no one is a saint in this situation, but needless to say, I think you got to put the art first. They could have sat down together and hashed it all out.
Yeah.
But the point being is they were going, you know, they were concerned about going over budget, over schedule. So like, all right, here we go. We're going to stop on the second one. We'll put a pause on that. Let's wrap up the first one so we can meet our release date, and then we'll come back and we'll finish the second one. You know, the 20-25%, because again, they had finished most of the second film. So they did that, and part of this, though, and we'll get into this when we talk about how the Richard Donner cut turned out,
Part of this was, and I believe this was actually Richard Lester's suggestion, because Richard Lester was actually he was working on the first film. I think it was like creative consultant. He was around at some point to kind of help things get done. And as the story goes, this is how I read it or heard it. They were coming to the end of the first film, and they didn't really have. They felt like, well, there's not enough oomph here. Like, we need some kind of emotional beat. And the end of the first film, as scripted, was, oh, well, Superman, he stops the two missiles, right?
Yeah.
But then he throws one of the missiles into space, and that breaks open the Phantom Zone, and it's like a cliffhanger. You know, it's not really like a big beat. But then they decided, well, let's take out the cliffhanger, but then there's really nothing to hook people at the end. You know how we're going to reverse the time at the end of the second one? Let's move that to the first one. Right? Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, okay, now we have an ending. Great. So that removes the ending for Superman 2, but they're like, okay, well, we'll figure it out when we get there, right?
Yep.
Little did they know it would be 2006 by the time they got there, but...
Yeah, right.
So then Superman the movie comes out. It's a huge success, right? But then in the interim, before production starts again on Superman 2, the Donners and the Salkinds have these issues, and they, you know what, they fire Donner and they bring on Richard Lester. And that's why Richard Donner felt a lot of resentment, because Richard, it's like a knife in the back, because Richard Lester was there on the first one. He felt like he'd been replaced. So we get to Superman 2. But then let me ask you this, John. How do you feel about the end of Superman the movie and the time reversal? Because for me, in that one instance, I like it, because it's an emotional one-off thing that they did make an effort to tie into the rest of the film with, it is forbidden to interfere with human history, mm-hmm. right? That was not what that line meant when it was said, but they found a great way to kind of drive the point home. And he flies up to the sky, and that primal scream from Reed, that is possibly his best moment of acting in the whole franchise, is when Lois is dead and just everything stops and these fades. And then he, you know, goes up to the sky, reverses time, saves Lois, right? It works there as a one-off emotional thing for me. And a lot of people say, well, that ruins the whole movie. I don't feel that way. A lot of people do. But if you love it, the movie so much, it seems like it works for you too.
I'm in the same camp. And the reason I'm in the same camp is because I think that there is... We live, I think, in sort of an odd space in history where people don't acknowledge the power of love as an emotion, not the way that they used to. I don't, in terms of storytelling, I guess. There seems to be some sort of feeling that it's passé to believe that, you know, being in love with somebody could generate such a strong, unbelievable emotion and, you know, emotional reaction. And the whole reason the ending works for me is because I'm a romantic at heart. And I think anybody who's truly been in love, who's truly lost their sense of, you know, that pit in the stomach that I would do anything for this person, and he's already got the trauma of, I couldn't save my own dad. I mean, you know, Jonathan Kent's his dad, really. Mm-hmm. You know, he never knew his birth father. He's lost it, and he says, you know, all my powers, and I couldn't save him.
Right.
And then to be faced with that, you've finally fallen in love, like real love. Like, he's all Superman wants to be is part of society. He wants to be human, and part of being human is falling in love and having that magic, you know, go on. And, you know, regardless of whether it's a person or a calling or something like that, it's, you know, and you lose your heart completely, and he just snaps. And it's not like he stands up the way he would in, you know, an MCU movie, and Coley says, oh, well, if we do this, we could turn back time and go through with the Infinity Gems or anything like that. He just flips out, and the first thing he can think to do is, I'm going to turn back time. He's not even thinking, oh, I can do this, or, oh, I should do this. He's just a man driven by passion in that moment. And I'm totally down with it. I think anybody, you know, when you're a human being, there are moments where you're going to snap, where you're going to lose it. And he loses it in that moment. But instead of like a villain who loses it and starts punishing or destroying people, he puts everything he can into finding a way to fix it and make it right again. So
I love that. That's a great way to look at it. And
thanks, man.
With Superman, he's a very powerful being. And this is, again, this is pre-crisis Superman, when he could do some crazy stuff. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility he could fly as fast to break the time barrier, right? And a lot of people say, oh, he's reversing the rotation of the Earth. It's a joke to a lot of people. I joke about it myself on social media. Whenever we got to wind the clocks back or forward, I always post a picture of this. To me, it's a visual representation of him traveling through time. He's not literally reversing the rotation of the Earth, people. I mean, that's right. I don't know how to need to explain that to people. Film is a visual language, and that's what it's showing you, right?
Right.
And he goes back in time like 10 minutes, okay?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't go back in time days, weeks, years, whatever, right? So it works for both of us. Put a pin in that. We'll revisit that in a bit when we get to the end of the Richard Donner cut, unfortunately. Yeah. But Superman 2, right? Growing up, I loved it better than the first one, right? It's like, oh, he's throwing punches and he's fighting. It's more exciting. Zod's like a fun villain, and you know, a lot more his secret Lois and all. So much is going on in Superman 2. And this is way before I knew anything about this production stuff. Because when you're a kid, you just accept, well, this is the movie. You just accept it the way it is. And these superhero movies, right? These are the movies that kind of, in science fiction movies in general, these are the kind of movies that really got me into like learning behind the scenes about stuff. Star Trek as well, obviously. For me, as you guys have heard me say on this podcast, but like later on, I guess I was in college or high school, I guess. And I came across this site called Superman Cinema. And it was this website about the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. And there was a forum there, and I kind of fell into this rabbit hole of all this stuff. And then I learned about this Richard Donner, you know, the situation where he had filmed most of the movie and a lot of stuff was refilmed. And then, having, you know, you learn about this and you go back and rewatch it, and the seams are pretty evident when you watch the theatrical version. And then, you know, when the Donner cut came out, like I honestly got kind of worn out on Superman 2 after a while, because all the, you know, online, because we kind of live in these online debates and conversations, John, being like podcasters and fans, and it gets exhausting after a while. I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm done with Superman 2 for a while. So I hadn't watched it in a long time. But then in doing this podcast, I rewatched both versions earlier this week, and I'm proud to say that I still love Superman 2. I don't love it as much as I used to, but it's still a very enjoyable superhero movie with a lot of charm and a lot of heart. And I think, and this is how we can kind of dovetail into things, really getting into it here, I'd say the theatrical version, even with all the warts and all, that's the one that holds up for me. And the one that, if you say, which version of Superman 2 are you going to take on a desert island with you? I'd say the theatrical cut.
I do agree with you. The Donner cut, I think, is one of those things where, it, to its detriment, it doesn't have the advantage of being finished. And, you know, he says as much like in that introduction where he's like, you know, we just, you know, we're subbing in this and that. We would have done these things differently, but this is the best we could do. And all the credit in the world to them putting it together and releasing it, because having that knowledge, I think, is really key to understanding, you know, how that creative process works and how films do change a lot on the fly. How, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, there are clear differences between the script and the novelization and the final cut and the this and the that. And it's because film is a very organic process, or at least it can be. And you might come up with an inspiration on the set, your writer is on set with you, all of that sort of thing. So I think the Donner cut is intellectually more satisfying because I can see more of the intent behind it. And in a lot of ways, story-wise, it's a little bit richer and more fulfilling. I think that Superman goes on a little bit more of a journey in Donner's version of things. But that being said, I think that Superman 2 is it's undoubtedly a lot of fun, and yes, there's still the thrill at its core. It's the thrill of that childlike thing that drew us all to Superman or comic books, or Superman comic books in specific or whatever, of that childlike thing of coming to it and saying, yeah, well, Superman's tough, but what if somebody else showed up who had his powers? Oh, please, it could probably take one. What if it was three? You know, like it's that childish sort of upping the ante sort of thing. And you, in either version, though, what you cannot take away is Terrence Stamp as Zod.
Right.
He's like Chang in Star Trek VI. That movie doesn't work without him. And it's because he knows the material that he's in, and he loves it the same way that Christopher Reeve loves it. He's not making fun of it. He's embracing it, and he's all on board for it. And, you know, I mean, all that said, I do not care for Superman 2 as much as the first one. I think that there is a marked drop in quality, and, you know, the Gene Hackman stuff is... It's unfortunate, you know?
So that's part of the reason I wanted to talk to you about Superman 2, because it has not been, you know, one of the great superhero movies in your opinion. And so what does kind of bring it down for you? Just like the different versions aside, you know, because I would think Hackman's, you know, if you accept the Lex Luthor we got in the first film, which again is pre-crisis, okay, so you got to keep that in mind. But if you accept that one, what's so different about him in this film, which drags it down for you?
I'm talking specifically about the fact that they had to shoot around the fact that, you know, that Hackman was just like, no, if Donner's not coming back, I'm not coming back either. You already got my work. And it's, you know, in a large sense, I can respect it. And I can sort of marvel at the fact that they said, fine, we'll just put a wig on somebody and shoot around you.
And we'll do some voice, oh, mush, Mr. Schumacher, mush. I'm like, is that Gene Hackman saying that? I don't know.
He still manages to be a scene stealer, which is amazing. Like when he comes into the wrecked offices of the Daily Planet, you know, with his handkerchief, just like, hey, hello, you know, like that's legitimately, Australia.
Yes.
That is some legitimately funny stuff. But that's again where those seams show. I think that the ending, it's a bit deflating. It's a little bit weird because, you know, I mean, who doesn't make fun of the cellophane S?
Yes. Right?
The illusory cellophane S. And the ending's a little too tied up and a little too pat, even though it still has, you know, the great moment of him turning around and crushing Zod's hand.
One of the greatest moments in cinema.
But then you have him, you know, throwing them down into the abyss, as it were, right? Which, you know, our whole big thing has always been, as, you know, superhero fans and everything, is like, well, Superman doesn't kill people, and that makes a big difference. Well, no, he threw three people to their deaths.
With a smile
clearly
on his face.
Yeah, he thought it was great.
Well, that's because, and this is a scene that's not in it, either of the two versions, right? There is a scene with the Arctic police.
Yes.
Because that's a thing, apparently.
Yes.
And they come and you see them in the background arresting the three villains. You're like, oh, okay, well, they're alive. And then there's a continuation where they come and they get Lex Luthor. Because in both versions of the movie, Superman just leaves Lex Luthor in the fortress. And in the Donner cut, he then destroys the fortress. So you're led to believe he just killed four people.
Yes, that's true. Stone cold murderer.
I will not understand why the Donner cut didn't insert more of these scenes. They're on the DVD. Like, oh, well, here's some deleted scenes. No. This is the Richard Donner cut. You need to put in all the scenes that Richard Donner shot. And it would have helped the movie, and especially the runtime, the Arctic police, that there's a couple other small bits they could have put in. Like when the villains show up to try to enter the fortress, there's like a force field they have to get through or something. And that's not in either version, official version of the movie. Now, it is in the aforementioned restored international cut that was on TV in the 80s, but it's not in these other versions. So it's crazy to me they didn't do that.
I think also one of the things that irks me is I remember as a kid, the scene with, you know, where he's fighting them in Metropolis. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, that blew my mind. I was like, this is crazy. Oh my gosh, three Superman people are attacking Superman. And
the
it's
big
oh
one's
my
just God. As strong as Superman.
Yes. And when she shoves her. Yeah.
Yes.
You insulted my boyfriend. although I will say that Nod is, when he's floating and he does that sound, still scares the hell out of me. When I was a kid, I was terrified of that guy. And actually, to go back to Star Trek VI, I think when they lose the gravity on Gorkon's ship, there's that guy who's floating. And he goes, and it's just like that shot. And it scared the hell out of me. but that scene, and I think part of this is just because our standards for movie fights among superheroes has changed over time. it's one of those things where I look back on it, and when I rewatch it, it's, oh, it's cute. It's of its time. You know, it doesn't hold up, whereas there's nothing in Superman the movie where I go, oh, that's cute. Like, Donner knew what to show and how to show it, sort of thing. And I think mm-hmm. that it would have been interesting if he'd been given a real opportunity to really work on and keep tweaking things, and say he would have known what worked and what didn't, and found a way to make it all flow a little bit better.
Well, yeah, that's a big section of the movie that he didn't shoot anything for. Maybe a couple of test shots, which they kind of they switch out a few things in the Richard Donner cut for the Metropolis fight, but it's mostly addition by subtraction, because Richard Lester injected a lot of humor, quote-unquote, into the final battle.
You mean like the guy in the phone booth?
The guy in a phone booth still just talking away on the phone, having the time of his life. You get ice cream blowing off cones. You got toupees flying off. It's like, really? Like, and even with that material, just cutting it down and making it more serious, way better. You know, I would say the that is seriously improved. But yeah, I know what you're saying. And but even so, Superman throwing Zod into the Coca-Cola sign, right? These are iconic things. And I remember when I saw Man of Steel for the first time. Now, I like Man of Steel more than most people, I think. I'm not really. It's hard to gauge on the internet what levels that you're supposed to or not supposed to like things at.
Yes,
but
that's true. Yes.
When I saw it, I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is like the first two Supermans put together, but on steroids, and I never need to watch those other ones again. Like, I was riding the high of Man of Steel at the time.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, you know, seeing how the DCU went and whatnot, what's that website we use? Letterboxd.
Yes, Letterboxd.
So, you know, that's a fun thing. Ever since me and Brandon started Franchise Fatigue, I got a Letterboxd account and I rank everything, and you're quite active on there. So it's fun to see what people are watching, how they rank things, you know. And so, you know, you can make lists. And so I make a list of like the Superman movies, right? And I put Man of Steel second. But then after rewatching Superman 2 again for this, I'm like, no. Superman 2 is, for me, Superman 2 is better than Man of Steel, just because there's like, yes, it's cheesy and kitschy in these fights, but there's so much more heart in them, you know, than like look at Superman and Zod just fight each other and blow stuff up and buildings are collapsing everywhere.
I will absolutely concede that point to you, because Man of Steel has a different DNA about it. There's a different sensibility, but at the very least, Superman 2, including that fight, there is still a sense of fun. It goes overboard at several points. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Phone booth guy is like, if I were teaching some sort of like comedy in film class, I'd be like, now let me show you going too far. That would be the scene. But that fight still has some crazy stuff, not just throwing him into the Coca-Cola sign, but when he's shooting the eye lasers and then he grabs the mirror and turns it back on him. Mm-hmm. And it blows back, and like you see that little, like everything's burned except for his silhouette, sort of thing.
Yes.
Like that's super cool. You know, that's still really neat, and it still has that verve. But I think a lot of that, again, goes back to Terrence Stamp and Christopher Reeve and the way they approach the material. And Margot Kidder, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't take anything away from Margot Kidder. I think she gets overlooked a lot in discussions of the Superman films.
Yeah.
But she was a big part of why they worked as well. But, this is one of those things where, like, when I'm secluded away in my little hermitage of soul and I can really work up the hatred for Superman 2, oh, I really go after it. I love tearing it apart, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But now as I'm, like, talking it with you, I'm like, you know, yeah, okay, that's kind of cute. That's okay. There are still things that just fall so flat for me, though. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it has to do with the production quality in the stuff that Lester reshot is so far off.
Yes.
That watching it as an adult, like, it bothers me, where I'm like, wow, look at how beautiful that shot is. And he's walking on the water. Oh, what happened there?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing with that is, and it becomes more evident when you see it side by side in the Donner cut. And I will give the Donner cut this, because there's a lot of good about the Donner cut. Don't get me wrong. Right. That's what makes this so complicated.
Yeah.
But it really cleans things up. You know, even the color timing. A lot of people criticize, and I'm one of them, like how everything gets color timed to more like blue, like a cool look, a cooler white balance and everything, and in modern films and stuff. I actually prefer cooler white balance on most things, you know. But it really helps Superman too, because even like if you look at the Fortress stuff in both versions, it looks a little dingy, it looks a little brownish, a little yellowish in the Lester cut, and that kind of like that. It's like that something about the 80s, like TV and movies have this brownish haze over everything. Like that is in this movie.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that has to do just with, the type, because I know that through history, like the types of celluloid that they use, that they shot on changed. And I know that some of the stuff didn't stand up as well. And, I think it's a fairly modern thing that it wasn't just the Criterion collection that was going back and like recolor timing from the original negative or the, the first time I learned the word interpositive was during one of the Halloween re-releases where they were like mastered from the original interpositive. And I was like, oh, that's great. I have to go look up what an interpositive is and, figure that out. So,
well, even stuff like you talk about Donner knowing what to show, not to show, even stuff like Superman losing his powers, right? Mm-hmm. Like the skeleton stuff and the whole, and you talk about that deleted Luther's gauntlet stuff that you shot to that Superman in the fire, like that screams 80s to me. Like the look of that, there's stuff like that in the theatrical cut that's like, this is the 80s, and the Richard Donner cut, done 2006, it's 25 years later because the original film came in 1981. Although then they themselves do some like, oh, this is some 2000 stuff, because when they pause time and reverse it at the end, there's stock footage of just people walking down the street in New York circa 2005. And I'm like, that's, what are you doing? Like, I'm sure you could have found something from the 70s or 80s. Yeah. So it's not that they both, that's what's tough about this. Like, the movie itself is its own thing, and they have these two versions, and I truly believe the best version lies between both these versions. Because Richard Donner, his objective was, I'm going to take out as much Richard Lester stuff as possible, only use the absolute bare minimum. And I understand where he's coming from. Because, again, he worked with Richard Lester on the first one. He took his job. He felt betrayed and has a lot of just animosity about this whole situation that he will take with him to his grave, which if you talk to him and see him in any interview, you can see this. So I felt like that kind of blinded him to the fact of, like, all right, what's the best version here? I understand it's called the Richard Donner cut, not like the special edition or the final cut or something. But if Blade Runner can get like five cuts, I feel like Superman 2 is deserving of one more pass of like the ultimate edition, to borrow a phrase.
That would be pretty great. I think that it would be really, really a positive thing if they could find that middle ground. I doubt they ever will, especially since Donner is still holding a grudge.
Yes.
And who knows what the DGA would say about it either. I mean, they could probably get away with it if they gave like a double credit at
directed
the end.
By Richards, Lester, and Donner.
Yeah. Hey, man, directing duos are the big thing now. Look at the Russo brothers, right? Chris Miller and Phil Lord, like, actually, directing duos are becoming the thing now.
Yeah, Zack Snyder and Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
Ironic that Justice League is Superman 2, right? I mean, that's what it is. Basically. Like, as of this recording, we're in the height of the hashtag release the Snyder Cut stuff. Like, I want to see the Snyder Cut just to see it out of curiosity. But I'm not going to go burn down Warner Brothers to get it. Like, it's just people get so polarized and like fired up about this stuff. And I just, the internet, man, right?
Well, I mean, in a large sense, though, I think that, the mere existence of the Donner Cut keeps that whole argument alive. Yeah. That's such a new and weird thing. Like, the idea that we even have the Donner Cut is such a modern thing because, problems on set and stuff like that still go on. They still at Disney, Lucasfilm fires people like a bodily function.
Lucasfilm reshoots pretty much every other movie they make, right?
Yeah, that's their track record so far. But I loved Solo, so whatever.
Rogue One, the Darth Vader scene in Rogue One at the end? Yeah, reshoot. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah. No, reshoots aren't in and of themselves a bad thing, but it's funny too, because I hadn't thought about Justice League in terms of it being a Superman 2 thing, but there really is, because you can see the seams in that as well.
Oh, yeah. It's inconsistent within itself and in the franchise. Ugh.
And the thing that kills me about it is, like, the stuff that I can tell with Snyder's, I really am intrigued. I'd like to see more. Like, okay, exactly. Show me what he was working on here. Maybe this is going to be the thing.
And is it complete sitting on a shelf? No, right? But yeah. I think it's a lot more finished than people claim. Zack Snyder himself, and recently, as of this recording, Jason Momoa has said that he's seen a version. So, like, there is a work print version. Special effects keep getting leaked. You know, it's like, it's only a matter of time. I understand they don't want to come out with it right now. That wound is too fresh, right?
Yeah.
But within the next 5 or 10 years or so, I believe we will see a Snyder cut of Justice League. Hopefully, we don't have to wait as long as we did for Superman 2.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope not.
But, you know, to get to the Superman 2 stuff, get back to that, there's stuff that's a lot of the heart, I would say, it's potentially lost in the Donner cut, because rewatching these, I realize that the Lester cut, you don't know how much time has passed between the two movies. The Donner cut implies, like, this is immediately after the first one. Lex Luthor has apparently been tried, convicted, and sentenced in, like, a day or something. Right?
Hey, you have the right to a speedy trial, Zach, okay?
There you go, right there
in the Constitution.
So, but the Lester cut, it kind of establishes, like, this friendship between Lois and Clark. You buy that, you know, that... They have their own stuff going on. They have the orange juice, freshly squeezed in joke that keep going, which, by the way, that joke remains in the Niagara Falls scenes of the Donner cut, but there's no setup for it because the scene that set it up was a Lester scene, which they dropped. So you're like, what is he talking? Oh, yeah, orange juice, freshly squeezed. Like, what are you talking about? That wasn't in this. Like, if you only seen that version of the movie, you have no idea what Clark is talking about.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, you're right.
And they went to such lengths to cut around the Lester stuff. The Niagara Falls stuff just disappears. You know, it's like they're there. You blink and you miss it. And this ties to the two things from the Donner cut. Which version of Lois trying to find out Clark's secret do you like better? The Donner version of jumping out the window or the Niagara Falls stuff from the Lester cut?
If I'm honest, the Niagara Falls stuff, I don't know if that is a function of nostalgia or not, but it really, I think, speaks more along the lines of the, you know, even Donner's stuff in the original one, the little over the top. Mm-hmm. There was an acknowledgement that this was a comic book reality sort of thing. And I think that jumping off of Niagara Falls is a comic book exaggeration that I'm more willing to give a break than jumping out of a window.
Yes.
Because jumping out of a window is a horrifying thing that conjures up suicide and it's, oh no, but somebody jumping off of Niagara Falls is like, oh, that's crazy. That never happened in real life.
Or you could conceivably not immediately die if you're wrong.
You know,
in Niagara Falls. So, and I understand that's a byproduct of, oh, we have to. Well, the thing was, right, when they decided to replace Richard Donner, you're asking, probably, if you're not familiar with all this stuff, you're asking yourself, why did they reshoot all this if they had it all? Because they wanted to give Richard Lester director's credit, and you have to direct, I believe, more than 50%, or there's some percentage, you have to direct this percentage of the movie. That's why they redo scenes in different locations. And so they took from the Donner cut, Lois jumping out the Daily Planet window, which... these are scenes that we had never seen. These have been in a vault for 25 years. So when you see them, like, this is amazing. This is 1970s Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder playing Clark Kent and Lois Lane. This is stuff we never, it's like a gold mine, you know?
Yeah.
So, but once you kind of like, it's like seeing, and you know, this is how I feel about the special edition of Star Wars. It's like once you get over the fact that the Jabba scene is like, oh my God, it's Harrison Ford from 1977. Once you get over that like new shiny object feel, you're like, oh, well, that ruins the reveal of Jabba in Return of the Jedi. It ruins the reveal of the Millennium Falcon like two scenes later in A New Hope, you know? And it repeats information that we get from the Greedo scene where Han Solo shoots him. So,
well, that's because I think that if you're going to have Jabba, you should cut Greedo, but you can't cut Greedo. But I think that would have actually solved a lot of the problems. But hey, that's just me.
That's true. But, you know, once you remove yourself from that, like we're doing here, like, oh, it is a lot more realistic that she would jump into water than onto a concrete 100 feet below.
Especially out of a building that just previously, when she first met Superman,
she
already had a traumatic event happen with that building.
She has no post-traumatic stress syndrome about that helicopter accident.
Yeah,
it's interesting because in the Lester cut, you know, they show up and Clark's like, wow, you know, Mr. White says that they're charging those newlyweds for every cent they've got, right? And then when you see the Donner cut, you see the scene where Perry White pretty much tells him that. Word for word. Yeah. It's interesting that they kind of picked that thread up and the reshoots. But, you know, speaking of, you know, Niagara Falls, Margot Kidder, like, you know, unfortunately, she kind of started her fall into a dark place with, like, drugs and alcohol and her mental issues that she was having. And so that was affecting her physical appearance.
Yeah.
And you can really tell the difference between the Donner footage and the Lester footage by just her appearance. It's drastically different.
Yes, it is. And it's a shame. And it's, you know, I really think that there is, it's odd because there are so many cautionary tales about people who have gone down that road. Hmm. And it seems like people in Hollywood never learn the lesson. And it's really sort of, it's almost like the problem they have in the NFL where, you know, oh yeah, we have one life coach meetings. Don't spend your millions of dollars before you're out of the league sort of thing. And it's like, no, you really should probably do more than that. Maybe, I don't know, like talk to people and stuff. But yeah, that is definitely one source of the obvious disparity between the two. Two sets of footage.
Now, that said, I think she gives a great performance, and I think, you know, her chemistry with Christopher Reeve is very evident throughout the whole film, and it brings a lot of heart to it, which is not there in the Donner Cut, because she, you know, they use the whole, like, they use screen test. I mean, they put a disclaimer up, say, we used a screen test to complete the scene where, you know, Lois catches Clark's secret by shooting with a gun, but it's really a blank, and Superman would feel if it was a bullet or not, I think, so that's a flawed concept.
Yes.
Because he says, well, you know, Lois tries to catch Clark Kent being Superman again. She pulls a gun on him. He's like, Lois, what are you doing? And she shoots him. And he's like, well, you realize, of course, if you've been wrong, Clark Kent would have been killed. And she's like, with a blank? And he's like, oh, you got me. But that's like, oh, you would feel a bullet. Also, not as romantic as the Lester Cut. Because he trips over this pink bear, which a lot of people joke about. But he drops his glasses into the fire. He reaches in there. You know, Lois sees him without his glasses, also that his hand isn't burned. Throughout the last two movies, she's like, you are Superman, aren't you? And much like the scene in the first movie where he kind of like takes up, where he's in Lois's apartment, he takes off his glasses, he stands up straight. You see Clark Kent become Superman in that moment. Yeah. You see it from the back here. Clark goes up these stairs. You see him like, his posture goes up. He takes the glasses off. He turns around. He's Superman. And he's like, I don't know why I did that. She's like, well, maybe you didn't want to with your head, but you wanted to with your heart. And people might think that's schmaltzy. Like you're saying, John, the respect for the concept of love and the power of love has lessened in recent years, it seems. But to me, this is romantic.
Yes, I completely agree. I do think that is a great reveal. And the thing is, that has definitely stuck with me through the years, because I have always loved... I mean, the fact that Christopher Reeve also plays it in a very, the physical way that he plays that stumble and that trying to cover up his hand, he does such a great job of, you can believe Lois thinks that he's covering up his hand because he just, you know, oh, no, don't worry about it. But he has this sort of posture to his hand that lets you know, like you're in on why he's really covering up his hand. You know, after going into the fire and everything like that. And it's just a really strong scene. It really is.
And I love how he says, we better talk. And she says, I'm in love with you. And he says, then we really better talk. You know, it's this great dialogue, you know? And that carries through the whole thing to the end of the film. And we can talk about this and then wrap back around to just a couple more things. Yeah. But the end of the film, right? They're back in the Daily Planet. Obviously, this is a Lester reshoot scene. Because in the Donner Cut, they have their same open office space from the Superman the movie. But in the Lester Cut, they each have their own offices. So they're in Lois's office. And it's a great scene between Lois and Clark. And they're talking about like how they can't be together. And Lois has been crying. And just Margot Kidder really brings it in this scene. She's like, you know how hard it is to walk in here and not be able to tell people that I know who you are. I don't even know what to call you. You can see the toll that it's taking on her. And Clark's like, what do you want me to say? And she's like, just say that you love me. And that's the same thing he said to her when he gave up his powers, you know?
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know what to say. He's like, just say that you love me, right? And so, like, you know, these little things tie it together. And yes, he does the memory kiss, right? Which is, you know, again, it's joked about now, much like the way Reversing the Earth is joked about. But where do you, what's your take on this whole thing?
When I was a kid, my brother had to explain it to me. Because he gives her the kiss, and then like she's just, you know, she's forgotten everything, and I go, "What happened?" What was that?
That's not one of his powers.
And my brother, big comic book fan, I think he called it, it's the kiss of forgetfulness. It's like, and, you know, even as a kid, what? But then to put it in the context of, you know, of what you're just saying, well, in the previous movie, he did stop and reverse time. Okay, fine. But that's the thing also that I think a lot of modern audiences lose is, and I actually point back to the original Transformers show for this too, believe it or not. But every single situation they were in, you would wind up finding out some crazy power that they had that you didn't know. Like I look back, I rewatched some of the original Transformers cartoons, and they're just sitting there, and they're dealing with some fire on an oil rig or something, and all of a sudden Ratchet just goes, "Oh, hang on," and his hand goes away, and then it comes out, and it's like a fire hose or something, and it's like. And you just accepted it. Yeah, well, of course he had that. So, you know, like, did you see him, like Zod, point his finger with a white beam and raise somebody up in the first one? No, but it's a power now. Okay.
Well, even in the Fortress, in the Lester Cut. The Lester Cut invents a lot of powers. Like in the Fortress where they're playing hide-and-go-seek, basically, and they're doubling themselves and... had they just made that super speed, it would have been one thing, but there's duplicates of Superman, and then he, of course, the cellophane S that he throws, like, what is this? You know, but it's the comic book world, and it was a different era, and I accept it. But again, the emotion wins over the logic to me in these endings of these films, both of them, really. And look, I think the better ending, like if you had to pick one, is they just end it where she knows a secret. Right. And it's like, this is the new, but this is back. That was not on the table back then. You know, that was like, we got to reset the status quo because we're going to have Superman 3 and 4, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully this goes on for a long time. That's their thinking. And they don't want to make this new dynamic shift of her knowing a secret. So I understand why they had to do it. I feel like they could have maybe come up with something else, but I don't know. So,
You would have only had like possibly a downer ending where like Lois leaves the Daily Planet and she's like, I just have to go off and think for some time, which is a comic book type of ending, but you don't want to end on a down note in these movies. It's all about, you know, letting the audience walk out with an up note. You're sort of painted in a corner, but you know, to your point, like let's go back to Man of Steel. That ends with her knowing his secret and
welcome to the planet. A great ending line.
Yes, it is a great ending line, but that ends basically, I think, where a modern audience would say that's where Superman 2 should have ended, is just with a tension of, well, where do we go from here? We'll come tune in next time and you'll find out. But you want a big, you know, especially in the 80s, you want a big epic ending. Yeah, you know, you've got Superman flying above the planet or Batman standing at the top of the cathedral with the bat symbol behind him, music swelling, walk out, I want a sequel sort of feeling.
Yeah, and that really takes us to the ending of the Donner Cut, which their solution was, well, this Lester shot all this, so we got to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Originally we planned to have him reverse time in the end of Superman 2, so we're going to do that now. It's like, no. I understand that was your plan in 1977.
Yes.
But 1978 happened, and Superman the movie happened, and you can't use that ending twice. And if there's one thing people make fun of, and I understand why they do, even though we accept it, John, the reversing time thing, you just did it again. did it again. And there's no emotional power to it. You just see the Earth reversing. And they had the gag where Perry White's brushing his teeth and the toothpaste goes back in the tube. Ha, ha, ha. Okay, but that is not worth it. Okay, because you have undercut this movie. For even the screen test thing, I'd be like, okay, it doesn't really affect the story as much. Like when they use the screen test of Margot Kidder and Christopher Reeve for her finding out a secret. Like that's strike one. Like, you get a Mulligan movie, all right? But you cannot do this for the end of this film. And that's, to me, ultimately why it undercuts this one for being like the definitive version of the movie, because he's just flying around the Earth and reverses time, and now everything's undone. Luther's back in prison. The prisoners are back in the Phantom Zone. Now it's like, okay, you just undid the whole movie.
I mean, the only really good ending for the Kryptonian criminals is to have them arrested by the Arctic police.
The Arctic police.
That's the only really, because it is, you know, as neat as it can be in the moment to have Superman, you know, kick their butts and throw them down into the abyss, you know, again, that it's kind of cold even for Superman.
Well,
you know?
people complain about Man of Steel, and that's its own 5-hour debate if you want to have it, right? But he kills Zod, right? But Zod is a superpowered being. And that's what I say. I think, and this is my stance on Batman and Superman rules, like Batman should not kill people because he is immortal. He is amortal, not immortal.
Yes.
He is amortal, and his enemies are also mortal. So there are ways to contain them without killing them. Superman, he's fighting, you know, robots and monsters and aliens, I think, like Doomsday, right? If you have to kill him, he has to kill him, right? But he just depowered these Kryptonians, and now he's just killing them with a smile on his face, as opposed to Man of Steel. So, anyway.
Well, the whole Batman killing people, I mean, you know, Tim Burton's Batman was more than happy to kill people.
Yeah,
when
you know,
necessary.
But you know, in 1939, when they invented the character,
I know. So. Oh, jeez. Well, you know, in the original serial, Zach, in the 1940s, he carried a gun.
Yeah. Let's out comic book guy each other with this stuff. But,
yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's a tough thing to do, but I just can't believe they all sat in a room and they said, well, let's just end it the way the script said in 1977. Like, it just blows my mind. Nobody said, no, you can't do this.
Yeah, I think though the Richard Donner cut is really just Donner indulging, you know, the fantasy that, you know, history didn't go the way that it did.
He reversed time somehow, John.
Right, exactly. but then he sat there and he said, you know, I'm gonna put it together the way I would have ended it because I know how I wanted to end it originally. But to your point, even if he had not left, if they had found some way to carry on, he would have had to have a different ending to Superman 2.
Exactly.
And you have to acknowledge that. So, yeah.
Well, you know, the one thing that cracked this whole thing open, to my knowledge, was Bryan Singer was making Superman Returns, and he wanted to use Marlon Brando as Jor-El in recordings for Superman Returns. So that kind of cracked open things with the Brando estate, and they got into the Superman 2 footage, and I think that kind of got the ball rolling. I mean, there were a lot of factors why this happened. But Marlon Brando, right, played Jor-El in Superman the movie, filmed all the scenes for both movies. But when Superman 2 came out, they were, again, the Salkinds being cheap. They didn't want to pay Brando for a second movie, so they cut him out of the movie, and they replaced him with Superman's mom, Susanna York, which is interesting because when I'm a kid, I'm not thinking about this. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. He talked to his dad in the first one, talked to his mom in this one. Cool, great. He's got both parents. That's great. But I didn't really think about, no, that completely undercuts all the stuff they set up in the first one. Like, he's all these crystals and random Kryptonians are reading poems and stuff like that.
I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. My whole life, that's been in my brain.
Yes, thank you, Superman 2, right?
Yeah.
So the huge advantage of the Donner Cut is having Marlon Brando in it and getting the powers back from his dad and all those, the Kryptonian prophecy, all that stuff they say, the father becomes the son becomes the father. Excellent that he's in the movie, although they make some weird creative choices with how he's like floating around. And sometimes you see his whole body. Like, he should have just been the giant, like, kind of black and whitish head he was in the first film. I don't know why they presented the footage this way, John. Did you find that weird? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it is weird, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know. I guess I just accept the idea that sequels are always finding for, you know, even if they're retreading territory, it's incumbent upon them, or they feel it's incumbent upon them to show you the same thing but slightly differently. Mm. You know, like, you know, to draw the comparison to Star Wars, like, to, you know, show up through Alderaan's wreckage, all they could do was just drop rocks at the camera. And they weren't happy about that. So they had the asteroid scene because they had more money, time, and expertise for Empire Strikes Back. So it was like, that was what that was supposed to be. So I can accept, you know, oh, well, it's the same thing, but, you know, to spice it up, it's going to be a little bit different.
Well, and the different crystals, they read different ways. And so I'm like, fine. There, you can fanboy justify that all day long. But ultimately, the one thing you always wanted to see was like, oh, man, because Superman 2, right? You're like, well, how did he get his powers back? Well, it's the green crystal. And in the theatrical version, I'm like, are they implying, because he's telling Lois, well, this crystal built this place and whatever. And he's showing her the crystal. Do they imply in the theatrical cut that, like, because Lois, like, forgot the crystal over there in the snow, that's the only reason that it still works? Because that's the kind of vibe I got last time. There was no explanation of why that ghost doesn't die. Right?
It's because it's green.
Which is an odd choice because kryptonite hurts Superman. And yet the key to this entire franchise is this green crystal, which is an odd color choice. But
it does seem inconsistent.
Yeah.
I will grant you that much. But it's the same color green as Luke's lightsaber from Return of the Jedi. So yes, we all win.
The best lightsaber.
We all win. Yes.
But, you know, it's great having the Marlon Brando stuff, although Christopher Reeve's performance is better in the Richard Lester reshoots. Because you can, it's just, it's not even in comparison, right? Because the Marlon Brando stuff they shot first. So Christopher Reeve, he crawls up to the fortress and he's like, oh, father, I've blah. He talking and talking and talking. But in the Lester stuff, the fortress is all dark. You know, it's moody. Mm-hmm. Christopher Reeve is a couple years later. He's a more seasoned actor. Like, I love how it's like, I know this is like pretentious and stuff, but it's like, the way I see it, and I often think this in my head, like he goes into the fortress and he's like, it's like he's talking to God. He's like, hey, mm-hmm. I don't know if you can hear me, but I need you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and he's like, father, and he calls. I'm like, man, that is like someone who is like at the bottom and they are calling out to God for help. And that's the vibe I get from the theatrical version of that performance and the whole ambiance there. And that, to me, that's way more powerful than, you know, a fully lit fortress and Christopher Reeve going on and on about world of your enemies and all that kind of thing. So
yeah, I agree, actually. I don't have anything to add to that.
Yeah, so and that's what I'm saying, if you cut from that to the Donner stuff of Jor-El showing up, that'd be like the perfect version. So this perfect version exists somewhere between these two movies. So I don't know, John, I think I might have to dust off my editing software and get to work and making some kind of ultimate version of Superman 2.
I'll tell you what, and since this conversation inspired it, I get a producer credit.
That's
so
right.
So there you go. Yeah.
Well, hopefully,
but I don't get the little PGA after my name though.
Right. So. Oh man. Well, so, yeah. Superman 2. There it is. You know, I mean, it's tough to talk about this movie without going on all those like, you know.
Oh yeah.
Trails and whatnot, and an inexcusable error of the Donner cut is replacing General. Would you care to step outside with General, haven't you heard of freedom of the press? I mean, I understand that was in the original script, you know, but General, would you care to step outside is an iconic line. I mean, one of my favorite lines in anything, period. And it ties into the scenes at the diner, which were shot by Richard Donner. That's why it's called Don's Diner. When he gets beat up by the bully and he's like, excuse me, sir, would you care to step outside? That scene, right? Amazing. What a feel-good ending, right? Going back to the diner, beating up the bully, which, by the way, in the Donner cut, after he reverses time, that guy would not know who he is, so...
Yeah.
I mean, you could read it like the guy's a jerk anyway, but everyone does seem to recognize him, and even the guy who runs the diner is like, oh, it cost me a fortune last time this place got messed up, and... You know, it's just such a satisfying ending when Superman goes back in there and lets the guy punch him, breaks his hand, spins him around, throws him down the counter into the machine, and then, of course, hands over a wad of money to the guy who owns the place. Like, oh, I'm terribly sorry about all the damages, sir. And then everybody looks at him, and he says, oh, I've been working out, which, again, implies that he's been there before and makes no sense with the time reversal. And that's a line that I quote all the time. If anybody says something about, you know, me being strong or something like that, or if I've said I've been to the gym, I'm always saying, oh, I've been working out. I have to do the glasses, push up to the face. Like, these are lines that are burned to my brain and that I will repeat in any applicable situation until the day I die. So Superman 2, for all these little intangible moments, just such an amazing movie in either form. But ultimately, you know, if you haven't seen Superman 2 in a while, dust it off, check it out. And if you had to check out one version, I'd recommend the theatrical. But if you have time for both, you should definitely watch both, because one has strengths where the other one doesn't, and vice versa. And like I'm saying, the ultimate version is somewhere in between. So, John, do you have any final thoughts on Superman 2?
You know, I came in here ready with a flaming sword to just talk about all the things that were wrong with it. But yeah, this is one of those conversations where I realize I was being sort of a jerk, you know, and like, wow, as I think about it, there is a lot more about this that I like. And there's a lot, this happens every so often with movies. The most famous one, among a certain circle of friends is when I did a 180 on The Shining. I spent decades, literal decades, beating up on that movie, and turned around on it with a rewatch and, you know, a more recent rewatch. And I think that this is one of those seminal moments where I've harbored such a grudge with Superman 2 for so many years. And I honestly think I wasn't really justified to have that much malice toward it. And you're right. The theatrical cut does just actually function better.
Well, there you go. We did it. Mission accomplished, everyone. We turned him around on Superman 2. So
the intervention is successful.
Kneel before Superman 2, John. You're so right about Terrence Stamp. Like, there, I love every Zod. I think every Zod is great. I like Michael Shannon. I like Callum Blue on Smallville. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of a spoiler, but when Zod shows up on the Krypton show that's on the Sci-Fi Channel right now, he's excellent there as well. I'm not going to tell you who he is or when he shows up, but Terrence Stamp has transcended pop culture. The whole kneel before Zod thing,
oh,
right?
Yes.
Everybody knows what that is. And like, even when I love the scene when he goes in the White House, right?
Yes.
And the president comes out and he's like, oh, God, Zod. Like,
yes.
So good.
But again, that's born out of a love for the material. Terrence Stamp knew why he was there, and he embraced it. He didn't fight it. He knew what was happening. Yeah.
And even when and there's something about the way they all play as like truly aliens, you know, they can talk to each other. It's like, this Superman, you know, he cares for these people of Earth, right? And these conversations they have, and they're like pets. I suppose so.
You know,
it's like they just don't understand. They're truly alien. And hey, good on the Donner cut for cutting some of that, you know, stuff in the Western town. And that was not a good look. And as someone who lives in Houston, Texas, by the way, I need to explain to people who don't, because you could miss it if you're not paying attention, right? They hear the NASA transmissions and they say, oh, glad it's Houston, right? The whole planet Houston. And they go to, because they're hearing NASA and whatnot. That's a very effective scene, the moon scene, by the way, shot by Donner.
Yes.
And they go to Earth and they land. Oh, very strange surface, right? But you're telling me they just happened to land in East Houston, Idaho? Like, why is there another, you know what the odds of that are? Like, so that's why people who, you know, and I understand why, be like, oh, well, Texas is like in the West. Right? Is this Houston, Texas? Like, that's the people think this, you know, when they watch this movie and have to say, no, they say East Houston, Idaho. I mean, if you're not paying attention, Admiral Mati, by the way, is the reporter. Did you know that?
Oh, that's right. Oh, you're right. He is. Oh,
not
going to
frighten us
yes.
with your sorcerer's ways, General Zod. So, but no, that's not Houston, Texas. I don't live in some podunk town like East Houston, Idaho. Okay. And hey, I'm sure East Houston, Idaho is a lovely place to live, also misrepresented by the representation here. Anyway, I could not talk about Superman 2 without getting that out of my system, for the record. So
Fair enough.
Well, John, it's been a lot of fun talking about Superman and Superman movies here. If people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Look for me under my online name, Kessel Junkie. I lurk on Twitter. I'm active, as Zach said, over on Letterboxd, right from time to time on KesselJunkie.com. And you can also hear me jabber-jawing about Star Wars on Aggressive Negotiations over on the Nerd Party. And I'm also a co-host, I think, on a show that is still on called Retro Perspective, where we are marching through 1994 a week at a time-ish and revisiting movies that are 25 years old this year.
Excellent. As for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronCSCH. I'm also a host of Standard Orbit, Trek FM's original series podcast. You can hear us every week talking about Captain Kirk and the Enterprise over there at Trek FM on Twitter. I'm also a host of Franchise Fatigue, which is the podcast that we have been mentioning through this conversation. John was recently over there. We talked about the Jaws series. As of this recording, we're just getting into the Terminator series, so tying into the new Terminator release, Dark Fate. So you can find us on Twitter at UFP Earth. Again, the show is called Franchise Fatigue, and I host it with my friend Brandon Shea Mattella. And this is I think this is the first time I've actually mentioned it. This was a good transition to kind of let you guys know that I'm doing the show here on this podcast. So there you go. If you want to hear me talk about movies, go over there. A lot of fun with my friends over there. As for the podcast itself, you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMalville with one S. You can find us on Facebook at Always Hold On to Smallville, and you can send us an email at alwaysmallville@gmail.com, once again with one S. Well, that's going to do it for us this week on Always Hold On to Smallville. We'll be back with probably one more special show. I'm thinking we're going to do a review of Krypton Season 2 before we get into our Season 5 of Smallville coverage, and then we'll be back to our regularly scheduled Smallville programming. But until then, always hold on to Smallville.